Either it's the biggest economic week in a decade, or, with apologies to the bard, it's much ado about nothing. We will wrap up the 5 days gone by. We've got Fruitcake 2 and a little bit of Star Wars. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, everybody, December the 18th. Good as always to have you with us. The Fed raises rates for the first time in 10 years. I'd say, yeah, that's where we're going to start our wrap-up of the week that was. For that, we've got Jolene Kent from Fox Business. David Gura is with Bloomberg. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
Gura, let me start with you. Gut check. Big deal, not big deal, much ado about nothing, or biggest week in 10 years? Discuss.
I think it was a big deal in that there had been so much anticipation of when this would happen. I think I'm telegraphing what Janet Yellen was thinking, which is you had to do it, had to get this started. So here the committee raised the benchmark rate to 0.25, which is 0.5%.
Right.
Now comes a new game where we guess what the pace of this increase is going to be going forward. I think most people are thinking there'll be 4 increases in 2016. Oh. But again, I think the big deal was getting it done.
All right. Time step there. 4 increases in 2016 from David Gura. I will say, Joe, just before we get to this next bit of the discussion, we've got Jay Powell coming up later in the show. He's a member of the Board of Governors at the Fed and also on the Federal Open Market Committee. So we'll talk to him about this. But I would love your sense of whether you think it's going to make a difference what the Fed did this week.
Well, it seems like there was a little bit of a difference. You know, the market didn't really move on Wednesday, and then you saw a hangover basically yesterday and today.
And
so
today,
what
yeah.
I'm really, yeah, exactly, 200 some points. But anyways, you know, looking at what it means for the broader economy, it's Asia's not in a great position. Europe is slowing down. And can the U.S. carry forward with rates still so low? What if something needs to happen with commodity prices continuing to drop and, you know, a tanking, basically.
Mm-hmm. And David, it's that's, you know, oil taking the bottom out of inflation and all that jazz. Do you think that they've just done this maybe to give themselves some room on the downside?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you bring up oil and Janet Yellen brought up oil. She talked about inflation, acknowledged the fact that it isn't where she or the committee wants it to be, saying, you know, look, exclusive of oil, maybe we're in decent shape. But it is hard to ignore that. And it's hard to ignore these headwinds. And I think what we saw over these last few meetings was the Fed really trying to reckon with that. I mean, going into this meeting, more bad news out of China on trade. So there were some headwinds there. And yet the committee still moved. So, yeah, I think you're right, Kai.
All right. Joe, let's move to Washington and the budget bill, the omnibus spending package that Congress passed today and the president has signed on his way to Hawaii. I was struck by the lack of panic, by the actual economic negotiations. You know, you had things like the oil export bill and all the rest of that. I'm wondering what your sense of is there momentum now toward normalcy in Congress?
Maybe, because it seems like everybody is celebrating. I was looking at the GOP comments and the Democrats coming out of Pelosi, and you really did see everyone say, oh, we accomplished something in a bipartisan way. But if you look at what people actually got out of it, neither party really walked away with anything that they really wanted. The GOP saying also, you know, too much spending and not enough on issues like immigration. Then the Democrats are saying, you know, they're worried about lifting this crude oil ban of what? 40 years plus, you know, spending. Yeah, spending is up, you know, $66 billion. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's pretty serious stuff. So, you know, all sides claiming that they won. A lot of this probably has to do with the honeymoon of Speaker Paul Ryan.
Right.
We will see if that lasts into the new year. But it seems like he's able to engender a little bit more discussion, at least on the House side.
All right. Well, so let's talk, David, about things going forward here. And I'm gonna play a piece of tape in a minute. Here's the setup. 60 Minutes on Sunday is going to air an interview with Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple. I, frankly, am fascinated to watch this because he doesn't do a whole lot of press. But Charlie Rose talked to him about the amount of money that Apple has overseas and what it would take to get it back into this country. And Tim Cook went off on the U.S. tax code. Here he is, Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple.
This is a tax code, Charlie, that was made for the industrial age, not the digital age. It's backwards. It's awful for America. It should have been fixed many years ago. It's past time to get it done.
He also, just spoiler alert, had some choicer words that we can't probably play on public radio. I don't know. But anyway, David, question is, do you think there is a chance now that one of the most powerful CEOs, if not the most powerful CEO in the world, is taking on the tax code that finally something's going to get done?
Yeah, and there, you know, there's a little two-face in this there. I mean, if he really wanted to pay the taxes that he could pay them, and we're talking about billions of dollars there. But you do have a guy who's running Congress now who is like a hobbyist when it comes to taxes. He loves taxes. He wants to do something about this. And you do see momentum growing, I think. But at the same time, you're seeing no end to these inversions, these attempted inversions.
Right.
You have this Pfizer-Allergan deal, essentially merging that company so that it can be in Dublin. So that continues. I think that's only going to whet the public's appetite for something to be done, something more to be done.
David Gura at Bloomberg and Jolene Kent at Fox Business. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Have a great weekend, Guy.
All right, you too. We'll see you. On Wall Street today, a whole lot of, oh, no, you don't, red ink as far as the eye can see. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Today, although you may not have been aware of it, is Free Shipping Day. Yes, another made-up consumer holiday designed to spin up retail sales. Does have its upside for you procrastinators out there, though. More than 1,000 retailers are offering free shipping, no matter how much you spend, with delivery, and this is important, by Christmas Eve guaranteed. But if they can do it now, why can't they do it all year, huh? Marketplace's Amy Scott has that story.
You can thank or blame Luke Knowles for Free Shipping Day. He started it 8 years ago when he noticed that online Christmas shopping tapered off after the 12th or 13th of December.
Being in the online shopping business, I knew that this was bad because we want to keep shoppers shopping online as long as we can.
And it's worked. Knowles expects retailers will do more than $1 billion in sales today. Richard Malang is director of digital marketing strategies at West Marine. The boating outfitter typically offers free shipping to its stores or for a minimum purchase. But in the competitive holiday season, it's across the board.
We have to be thinking about what our customer needs are. And we know that free shipping is definitely one of them.
So why not all year round?
I always call free shipping a frenemy of retailers because it drives sales up, but it is expensive.
Sucharita Molperu is a retail analyst with Forrester Research. She says it's not that easy to just pass on the cost to customers in the form of higher prices.
Because you're just one click away from going to Amazon anyway.
It was bound to come up eventually. For Amazon Prime customers, free shipping is standard, minus the $99 a year fee. Amazon won't say, but Molperu says Prime probably isn't even that profitable. But the company is such a Wall Street darling, it doesn't have to be.
And I think that why a lot of other companies get distressed is that they can't do the same thing.
Instead, Molperu says retailers compete selectively, offering free shipping on certain items or at certain times of year when the promise of free shipping drives enough sales to absorb the costs. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Women make less than men do doing the same job. That is not news, but it is what makes a recent review of salaries at S&P 500 companies stand out. The Associated Press took a look at what chief financial officers are paid and found that female CFOs are getting more than their male counterparts, $3.32 million for women, $3.3 million even for men, so $20,000 difference plus or minus. Marketplace's Sally Herships reports on that number and the gender wage gap.
So, ladies, before you get too excited about female CFOs earning more than men, listen to this reaction when I asked if male and female execs are paid at equal rates. Linda Barrington is executive director of Cornell's Institute for Compensation Studies.
I think what we're seeing in these latest numbers about CFOs may be a better indicator of a crack in the glass ceiling than overall pay equity.
Barrington says there are a lot of different factors that determine pay, like industry or company size. Nora McCord is managing director at Stephen Hall & Partners, an executive compensation consulting firm.
And the biggest driver of pay is the size of the company.
She says we need to consider what companies these female CFOs work for. It's likely they work at larger companies, which pay more. She says think more Fortune 200 than 500. But
let's be clear about what more is. It's really like 1%, right?
$20,000. That's how much more the female execs in the study were paid than their male counterparts. Not a ton. And why CFOs? Josh Christ is managing director with Christ Kolder Associates, an executive search firm.
Because the CFO actually had been the least diverse chair over time.
Christ says there's been a big push in the boardroom for diversity, and this latest jump in pay for female CFOs is a sign that it's working. But Stephen Hall and Partners' Nora McCord says in order to pay female executives more, first, we need more of them. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
...4,100 theaters, tens of thousands of showings, millions of moviegoers, including this one, set to spend 2 hours and 16 minutes in the dark, and that's just opening weekend for The Force Awakens. For Disney, the math is pretty easy. Sit back and count your hundreds of millions of dollars as they come rolling on in. But for theaters, though, maximizing profits from a phenomenon like Star Wars is a whole nother calculation, as Marketplace's Adrienne Hill reports.
Star Wars is playing pretty much around the clock. 5:15, 5:30, 6, 6:30, 7, 7:15, 7:30. I could go on. It's in 2D, 3D, IMAX. And scheduling all that?
This is a fairly complicated problem.
That's Josh Eliasberg. He's a professor of marketing at the Wharton School and a guy who knows a thing or two about optimal theater scheduling. He's spent a decade researching it. Among the calculations for theater owners?
Estimates how many tickets, you know, will be sold. How many screens to make this movie available on?
The time it takes for cleaning crews to pick up between shows, weather forecasts, holidays. And while it might seem easy enough to schedule Star Wars, just show it every 15 minutes until the crowds stop coming.
I think for Star Wars, it makes it more difficult.
First off, because the movie comes in 3D and 2D, so you have to predict demand. Also, theaters have to decide which movies they will stop showing. Early money goes to the studios. Theaters typically make more per ticket from movies that have been running longer. Jack Oberleitner is a theater consultant. He says a well-run theater keeps about 5% of ticket sales.
The real money to be made is at the concession stand,
where profit margins can run to 85%. This points to an essential piece of the scheduling calculation. Theaters have to make sure their movies start and end at different times so everyone has a chance to buy popcorn.
If you have enough staff and your crowd control procedures in proper setup, you're going to be guiding people right past the concession stand.
Get it wrong and you'll have crowds waiting to buy tickets, waiting in line for the bathroom, and not buying junior mints. Some theaters use algorithms and software to do their scheduling. Others still take their cue from Han Solo and go with their gut.
Sir, the possibility of successfully navigating an asteroid field is approximately 3,720 to 1.
Never tell me the odds.
I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Also, and just to be clear, Han shot first, you guys. All right, coming up.
There's been too much focus, and it's understandable, I guess, on just this one rate increase. What's important to people is our employers hiring.
One last word on the Fed's rate increase from one of its members. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 367 points, and yet somehow not the wah-wah trombones. 2.1%, 17,128. The NASDAQ off 79 points, 1.6%. Finished at 49.23. The S&P 500 down 36 points, 1.7%. Ended things at 2,005. For the week, the Dow off 0.8%. The NASDAQ down 0.2%. The S&P 500 down 0.3%. A little bit of corporate earnings news. How about that? BlackBerry. When was the last time you thought about them, huh? Well, BlackBerry reported another quarterly loss, but there were also signs the worst may be behind the phone maker, or, you know, so investors seem to think. When was the last time we heard that? Shares up 10% on the day. Biggest seller of used cars in the United States, CarMax, said revenue and profit were down last quarter because fewer people were coming into its stores. CarMax shares gave back 6%. Today I'm going to give you bonds here, even though I'm out of time. Bonds rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note, down to 2.20%. You're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is listener-supported, so please, to keep our coverage relevant and compelling, make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount counts twice thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from the Candida Fund. Help us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at Marketplace.org by December 31st, and thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Janet Yellen gets all the press, but there were 10 voting members of the Federal Open Market Committee at this week's meeting on interest rates. This week's unanimous meeting on interest rates, I ought to say. One of those yes votes belonged to Fed Governor Jay Powell. Jay, it's good to have you on.
Great to be here, Kai.
Do me a favor, would you, and help us make sense of the difference between what we're finding in our reporting out there, which is that a lot of people still feel stuck in this economy, and with what the FOMC and Chair Yellen and you guys in your statement the other day said is a recovering and strong economy. Help me make sense of that.
Sure. So the economy has actually recovered quite a bit since the global financial crisis. And one way to think about it is unemployment. Unemployment was at 10%. We lost about 9 million jobs in the financial crisis, which was the worst episode since the Great Depression, the deepest recession since the Great Depression. Since that time, we've generated 13 million new jobs, and unemployment has declined from 10% to 5%. So that's a really material improvement in the state of things. That's not to say that that's uniform across, you know, across different regions of the country, and it's not to say that every household, you know, feels better. But it's a fact that there's been significant progress, and I would hope that people would take our first very small rate increase as a sign that the Federal Reserve has confidence in the state of the economy and then the fact that we'll continue to make progress.
Noted that you said very small because it was, and we have to acknowledge that fact. How does raising rates, though, help the economy get better from here?
Little things like a 25 basis point increase aren't going to have a major impact. But over time, monetary policy does have a very big impact on the economy, and it does so over long periods of time with lags and gaps. So if you get so-called get behind on monetary policy, you have to raise interest rates too sharply, and that can cause a recession. So the right way to go, I think, is to start now with a very small increase and then move very gradually to avoid that.
Gradually got a lot of attention in Chair Yellen's press conference the other day. She made great efforts to say it's not going to be a mechanical thing without using her favorite phrase, which is it's going to depend on the data. What are you going to be looking at to think and to know when it's okay to start, you know, ratcheting things up again?
Well, we do look at a wide range of things. For me, at the top of the list will be continued progress in the labor market, and with it, continued progress on inflation. Inflation is even below our target. As I mentioned, the labor market has strengthened quite a bit, but I want to see continued strong job growth. We've had 3 years of very strong job growth. I want to see that continue. And as the labor market tightens, I'd like to see wages increasing. And as the economy tightens, we need to see inflation coming up.
You, I was about to say you guys, but it's Chair Yellen, has been very clear in her intentions, in the FOMC's intentions about normalization of rates. I wonder, though, whether you all got yourselves backed into a corner where you talked so much about raising rates that finally you had to do it, by gosh.
That's not how I see it at all. We want this to be a long, extended recovery and for it to continue for some significant number of more years. And I do think that the right way to do that is, again, to begin a program of very gradual, small rate increases. And that, by the way, that path will depend very much on the path of the economy. If the economy is weaker, then we'll know that, and of course, we'll react accordingly.
Does that mean you guys are ready to go back to the zero lower bound if you have to?
If you have to, you have to, yes. Okay. I mean, it's not impossible. Monetary policy is about forecasts. You have to have a forecast of where things are going to go, and you try to set monetary policy for what you see as the likely path of the economy.
Now that this first hike is behind you, how glad are you, how hopeful are you, I guess is a better question, to get the Fed out of the spotlight so that every discussion about the economy isn't, oh my God, what's the Fed going to do?
I'll be glad to stop talking about the first rate increase. There's been too much focus, and it's understandable, I guess, on just this one rate increase. What's important to people is, are employers hiring? Are their kids getting good job opportunities? Are their wages increasing? Are they feeling confident about the future? Are they able to afford a home? Things like that. And that's what we've tried to focus on, and that's what the public needs to be focused on. It would be just great to see the Fed get out of the headlines and let people get back to more normal considerations.
Jay Powell of the Federal Open Market Committee and the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve of the United States. Jay, thanks very much for your time.
Kai, thanks for having me.
Cake isn't for everybody. There are the doorstop jokes, the wrongly colored fruit, so much that is wrong with them. Although that might just be me, because despite its bruised reputation, fruitcakes sell worldwide. So, for today's installment of our series, The Holidays, brought to you by, we look at not one, but two, count them, two fruitcake producers.
Imagination.
Wonderful products.
Brought to you by...
Emily Jones from Georgia Public Broadcasting will tell us about one producer in the self-proclaimed fruitcake capital of the world, which happens to be Claxton, Georgia. But first, KERA's Lauren Silverman takes us to a bakery with a long fruitcake history in Corsicana, Texas.
In the 1940s, a German immigrant and a Texas businessman gave up baking bread for baking fruitcake. If you think that's nuts, you should try their product.
It's about 30% pecans. We use 20,000 pounds of pecans a day during season.
Hayden Crawford is a partner at Collin Street Bakery, which was founded in 1896. This afternoon, he's two-stepping in his lizard skin boots around giant mixers and boxes of dried fruit.
Here's the golden sultana raisins. Give you a look at what they...
Before refrigeration, fruitcake was a way to have a sweet treat in the winter months. Today, the bright red cherries, green pineapple, and other fruit are bound together by flour and honey, mixed by big metal claws and hand-decorated by women in hairnets. They churn out up to 20,000 a day during season.
You'll have a great evening.
Collin Street Bakery first became famous when circus showman John Ringling sent the treat to friends abroad. But sales in the U.S. started to wane about 15 years ago. So Crawford says the bakery shifted from rainbow-colored toppings to...
apricot from Australia. We have an apple cinnamon, which is you see here. We have what we call the Texas blonde. Instead of the red and green fruit, we just use pecans on the top.
That makeover also helped fix an image problem.
Instead of calling them fruitcakes, we started calling them pecan cakes. And that changed pretty dramatically the sales for our cakes.
Even with the name change and free samples, not every customer is convinced. Alma Garcia won't eat
no,
the fruitcake.
Don't.
What don't you like about it?
Oh, it's just so sweet.
Too sweet.
Yeah, I like it.
What do you get here when you come?
Just the cheesecake and a chicken sandwich.
Cheesecake might hit the spot, but it probably won't last as long as their famous fruitcake. In Corsicana, Texas, I'm Lauren Silverman for Marketplace.
And I'm Emily Jones in Georgia. That Texas bakery is the older establishment. But if you have fruitcake this holiday season, there's a good chance it will come from Claxton, Georgia. The tiny town's water tower proclaims it the fruitcake capital of the world. And across the street is the Claxton Bakery.
We take a lot of pride in that nickname.
Dale Parker's father bought this bakery from its founder in 1945. Remember the 20,000 fruitcakes a day in Texas? The Claxton Bakery churns out close to 90,000 one-pound fruitcakes a day during the pre-holiday rush. That's about 4 million every year. And it sells. Glenn Thomas is with Civitan International, which raises money for charities by stocking grocery stores with Claxton fruitcake.
Trust me, if some of the supermarkets do not have it in their stores by Thanksgiving, they will get questioned about it.
Some fruitcake lovers bypass the store altogether and go straight to the source. Parker says about 10% of Claxton Bakery's business comes from online and phone sales.
Yeah, they go everywhere. Ohio. Here's one going to New York.
Claxton's internet traffic goes up each year, which analysts say is true across the board in mail order food. Brian Todd of the Food Institute says there's been a surge in sales in the last few years.
A pretty substantial increase of about 30%, which far outpaces growth in many other food areas.
Though Parker admits his customers are aging, he's not worried about the business.
Do younger people like fruitcake as much as older people? No, probably not. But we're also doing chocolate-covered fruitcake pieces. So that's a way to market it to the younger population.
But cover it in chocolate or pecans, any way you slice it, it's still fruitcake underneath. In Claxton, Georgia, I'm Emily Jones for Marketplace.
The This final note on the way out today, we started with the Fed. We will end with the Fed. Just before the Senate left town on recess this afternoon, Majority Leader Mitch McConnell gave his Kentucky colleague and GOP presidential hopeful Rand Paul some holiday cheer. When they get back, McConnell is going to hold a vote on one of Paul's pet projects, a bill that would let the GAO audit the Fed's monetary policy decisions. That is what the Fed does on interest rates. And yeah, no, in case you were curious, Janet Yellen is not going to be happy about that. We know what she's thinking. All righty, we got to go. We did not get the wah-wah trombones today somehow, but still the Dow was off 367 points, 2.1%. The NASDAQ off 79 points, 1.5%. Percent and a half is another way to say that. The S&P 500 down 36 points, 1.7%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer around these parts. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.